Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Morreale coming to you from Boston, and we're doing a northeast-southeast discussion today. I have Kristen Zeman, the former chief in Aurora, Illinois. Good morning to you, Kristen.
Good morning to you.
We have been having some technical difficulties, and your patience is very welcomed. I'm sorry. But I want to talk about your book. I'm so glad to finally have you. You wrote a book, Reimagining Blue, Thoughts on Life, Leadership, and a New Way Forward in Policing. I've begun to read it, and I have to say I'm very, very impressed with the way you write, how down to earth it is, and how many tidbits are in here about leadership. And there's so many things. So let's start from your entry into policing. I know you started as a police cadet, and how you got to police chief, and tell us a little bit about Aurora, Illinois.
Absolutely. Well, so Aurora, Illinois is the second largest city in the state of Illinois, second only to Chicago, home of Wayne's World for those pop culture fanatics. It's all we got going for us. Something to bring up at your next cocktail party. So I'm born and raised in Aurora, Illinois, and I wanted to be a cop for as far back as I can remember. My father was a police officer, and you know, as early as 10 years old, I knew that that's what I want to do. And I had solidified that future for myself in junior high. And so I actually graduated from high school in 1991 in June. And I started as a police cadet, which is the equivalent of an intern, in July of 1991. So at the tender age of 17 years old, I started in my police department. I worked there for 30 years. And in the 3 years that I was an intern, you know, soaked up policing and of course solidified the idea that that's what I wanted to do. And interestingly enough, when I came on my police department, there were no females in rank at all. And we're a 300-person police department, so that's considered a mid-sized agency. Sure. And the fact that there were women on the job, but there were no women in supervisory positions. And I say that because people ask me, did you ever think that you would be the chief? And the honest-to-God answer is no way, because I never saw myself in those roles. There wasn't a woman who was holding any kind of rank, so it just never occurred to me. And then several females got promoted prior to my promotion to sergeant. And it was actually the great mentors that I had in my career. And they were males, interestingly enough, that said, hey, you should take the sergeant's test. And the same thing happened when I decided to go for it and take the lieutenant test. And I became the first female lieutenant in the history of my department, went on to become the first female commander and the first female chief in 2016. And I just retired last September with 27 years sworn, but 30 full years with my police department. So that is it in a nutshell.
Well, I'm guessing that people who would see you now, looking at you, you would see that you're in Naples, Florida, which is a great place to land, but that you are a lot less stressed than you were when you were on the police department. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh my gosh, that is an understatement. I'll tell you, you know, I love policing, and I'm glad that you said that. I mean, I love everything about it, but there are certain parts, of course, that the stressors, the bureaucracy, and, you know, discipline and contracts and fighting with unions and, you know, high stress incidents. But I will tell you, in the 6 years that I was chief, or five and a half, the first 3 years went swimmingly. And then, you know, 2019, we had a mass shooting, then a pandemic, and then civil unrest. And it was literally, I felt like I was a punching bag for about 3 years in a row. So yeah, to say that my stress level has gone down moving to sunny Naples, Florida is quite an understatement.
So we had the opportunity to talk before, and I apologize to the listeners if the audio isn't as normal. That's a technical difficulty on my side, but I'm so glad to have you. We have Kristen Zeman, and she's the former chief from Aurora, Illinois. You told me about the book, and that when I was asking, and by the way, congratulations, you have a second run. You have basically depleted the stock, and they're coming at you for more. So that's success. Congratulations for that.
Thank you so much. I'm completely shocked, but also very excited about it.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of, well, there's a couple of things that go through my mind. The first thing is to talk about the book, and you told me that you had started the book a while back, and then you just completely rewrote it. You wrote it on the inside, and you felt almost some relief to be able to write it outside. Talk about that a little bit. Kristen?
People ask a lot, well, you know, have you always written? And is that something that you just decided to do on a whim? No, the answer is I have always loved writing. I've always been a passion of mine. I wrote for the local newspaper starting as a police sergeant and had an editorial column that they were gracious enough to give me. That morphed into my own blog, law enforcement blog, and it became quickly one of the best law enforcement or top 10 law enforcement blogs per IACP. So I say that just to illustrate that writing has always been my therapy. And so a book wasn't too far off. I thought one day I'm going to put these thoughts from my blog and, you know, morph them into a book. And I sat down to do that in about, I think it was 2018, the end of 2018, and sat down just to write a leadership book, but not in the sense of I know what I'm talking about as leadership, talking about my failures, the things that I have learned along the way, and basically kind of a what not to do in leadership and what by watching others, sadly, what not to do. And I actually, interestingly enough, which I didn't mention before, is that after the mass shooting happened in my city, I actually stopped writing altogether. It was the weird mental block that I simply stared at the cursor. I just couldn't do it. And then when I started writing again and then decided to retire, it was actually last year, September of 2021, that I looked at the book and the form it was in and I rewrote the whole damn thing. And I did it because I am now able to speak freely. And not that I couldn't before, but as a sitting chief, I am, of course, work for a mayor, a city, a constituent, and of course, my police department. And so I had to weigh my thoughts and measure my words. And after I retired, I felt this freedom that I could say what I wanted to say. And so I decided to tackle also with the help of my publishing company that said, hey, you should talk about gun control. You should talk about George Floyd. You should talk about all the hot button issues, defunding the police. And I thought, oh man, here we go. Called it like I thought. And I understood in that moment that I may upset some people on both sides because I wasn't blindly loyal to police officers. I call out bad actions of police officers. Kind of that the same vein, I also decided to become very vulnerable in this book. And I realized that I can't tell the story of my life in the police department without talking about my personal life and my tumultuous childhood. And I mentioned my father was a police officer and he was my hero and he's the reason that I became a police officer. But the dark side of that is he was a raging alcoholic. And so I had to navigate those waters. And I sat down and for the first time in my life, I wrote down all of my experiences in life. I mean, so much so that my adult kid read it and went, Mom, you never even mentioned this before. And I said, yeah, I know. So the book is this, it's a culmination of my life. It's a memoir. It's a leadership book. It's a book about hot topics. It's a book about adversity. It sort of is this weird thing that I didn't write to one group. I just poured my heart out and hoped that people would get something from it.
But Kristen, as I'm watching you, I'm reading the pieces that you have read, the admission that your dad was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and certainly, and that's the first time I've admitted that, but I loved him dearly. You know, he had a weakness, but I loved him dearly. He still weighs heavy in my heart. Clearly, in our lives, we are molded by these experiences, and I understand that. But I also think that what you bring is a perspective, and the perspective is twofold. First of all, being a woman and having high rank, and I can't believe, look, listen, who've listened to the whole series, realize that I grew up when women were not allowed to be police officers, ever.
Yeah.
I was in the military police academy, in essence, and we accepted the first five women in 1975. Before that, they couldn't carry a gun, a sidearm, and they couldn't be an MP. And when I came out, it was the beginning of some money being thrown at it. We're now talking about 30 by 30, but this is back in 78, where I remember in my hometown, a police department I wanted to be a part of, they put women, they hired 20, whoever was the chief, knew how to get some money from the feds, and they hired 20 women at the same time. And the first thing that precipitated was the first protest I ever saw, and that was police officers, males, and their wives standing in front of City Hall and at the police station saying, no woman in my cruiser. I mean, in my husband's cruiser.
Wow.
I know. Yeah. So I've had that experience. I have three daughters, so I know. But so when I tell that story in classes, they don't get it, that we have come a long way since the 70s. But my question to you is, I'm sorry to weave in my story and my experiences, but my question is, you had to have had a tough time at first being one of the first women and overcoming and proving yourself. And talk about that experience, because clearly you overcame whatever the adversity was.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there are a lot of stories out there that are much worse than mine, that, you know, female police officers that have had to do to get their rightful position, either on the job or in supervisory positions. But what I also want to point out, that wasn't that long ago, Doc. I mean, this is, you know, you're talking 1975, and it's this recent past. It's not that long ago. And if you really wrap your head around that, yeah, it's incredible to me. So I guess we can look at what a credit in how far we've come. And you mentioned the 30 by 30 initiative, which is very close to my heart. And, you know, so of course we've made some, you know, great progress. But as I said, when I first came on, there was also some sort of this piece about me is that when I came on the police department, my utopia was just becoming a police officer. That's it. I had set the goal to become a police officer. And because I didn't think there was a possibility of me moving up, it was almost like, if you don't set any expectations, then you'll never get let down, right? But what you just said is we had one of our first female officers in the department. Her name is Karen Kraft, and she was my field training officer. She came on at the year I was born, in 1973, if I'm not mistaken.
So she was even before that.
And one of the first two females. And I was so excited to have her as a field training officer. And she was far less excited to have me in her car than I was. I mean, she was my idol. As a little girl, I watched her drive around the city and would say to my dad, "Who's that lady?" And he would tell me. But here's the rub. She didn't treat me very well, because later, I had 4 weeks in the car with her. And I finally, at the end of the fourth week, my marks were good. I was getting great ratings. And I looked at her and I said, "Why do you not speak to me? Did I do something to you?" And I think I kind of took her aback, and she paused. She made me pull over, and I parked, and she said, "I want to tell you a story." And she told me, you made me think of it when you, in telling the story about the protesting and the picketing. And she said she came on the police department and she went to the academy, and she sat at the long table, the lunch table, all by herself, and the males ridiculed her. And she got back to the station after graduating from the academy, and they put sanitary napkins in her mailbox and stuck them to her patrol car. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to all of this. And she said to me, "I think I haven't been kind to you, because when you walked in the department in 1991, that didn't happen to you." And she said, "I resented you." Yes. Yeah. And I was sitting there thinking, my gosh, if you could only see you the way I see you, and that you were the one of the first, and you had to hack through all of the brush and to pave that path. But to answer your question, for me, they weren't as overt as what happened to my field training officer. They were more subtle things. You know, I remember one day I looked up at the SWAT team. They had put up an announcement that they were taking applications for SWAT. And at that time I was doing some power lifting, and I was really in shape. I looked at the flyer and I was like, "Oh, no kidding." One sergeant just saw me looking at it and said, just started laughing. And I'm like, "What's so funny?" And he's like, "You can't try out for SWAT. You know, it's a man's club." Okay. You know, and I had little things like that. But then basically what happened is, I think that as a woman, we have to prove and reprove. And the things that happened to me, again, were more subtle, but it was lieutenant looking at my field training officer and saying, "Yeah, she's doing great in the program, but have you gotten her into a fight yet?" And I'm sitting right there and I'm like, "Yeah, hello, I'm right here." And my male field training officer said, "With all due respect, her, she is really good at talking people into handcuffs, and that's kind of what we're looking for, right?" And I could have just kissed that man right on the mouth that day, not in a sexually harassing way, but I was just so happy that he stuck up for me. But so it was like little things like that. And then, of course, as I started to move up, once I became a sergeant, then it became, "Oh, wait, she's a threat." And so then it became, which I call my mentors and my tormentors. And I have a lot of tormentors. But I think the biggest thing that I've had to overcome in my career is the stereotype. I'm 5'4", 122 pounds, and I've had people say to me as a patrol officer, you know, "Oh, do they let you drive a squad car?" And then I had people, as I moved up in rank, say, even women say, "Do those officers, male officers, listen to you? Do they follow you?" So there's this stereotype that goes with being someone of small stature and being a female. So, you know, again, they haven't been major obstacles, but just ones that just kind of little roadblocks I've had to navigate.
Well, if we could talk forever, I think, and is simpatico here. One of the things that I find in your book, and you just said tormentors, you know, and I think in most cases when you move up and you're doing some leading, and you actually said something about being a leader, you're going to disappoint people, that you learned at your Harvard class. But you call people who sort of take shots at you as tormentors, and I call them detractors. But there's always, you're never going to please everyone. And very often what has to happen, you have to find your core to say, well, there's two or three or five or 10 people who are kind of nipping at me, but I'm here for the other people who are here, the 290 95 others that are not tormenting me and the citizens that I am paid to protect and help the department through. But Kristen, one of the things I want to ask is this. I think having a woman in a leadership position can change the dynamic of an agency. Talk about being more willing to solve a problem, to get to the root of a problem rather than to arrest the problem. And I think we see an awful lot of that. I see so many more police officers now getting their social worker degrees to be able to do things. But let's talk about you, the experiences you had as you moved through the organization, watching maybe some autocratic approach or meetings that maybe were top down. Did you have those experiences? Okay. So I'm sure in the back of your mind, you're saying, this is what I don't want to do if I ever get the chance. So I want to know what approach you took when you were moving into the ranks. You're a commander, you've got some other command staff under you, you're pushing them forward, you're trying to collaborate to get things done. What was your style? How were your meetings different?
You said so much there to unpack and all the lessons that I've learned in leadership and sadly much about what not to do. And I can remember throughout my career, we had a great department, a progressive department, one that was very training focused. But basically the culture of the organization was those who got noted were the ones who were autocratic. In other words, they really credited those who put their thumb on people, those who were very disciplinarian, because that's how the personalities of the people in those positions running the department were at the time, very egocentric. And so that behavior got rewarded. And I remember, and that's, you know, kind of part of my writing process over the years, and I kept a journal talking about, if I ever get into a position, I will never do X, Y, and Z. And so the nice part about moving up in an organization is you get a little more influence. And I tell people that who are very frustrated that say, what am I supposed to do? I'm a sergeant. I'm a lieutenant. I don't have any juice. I can't display servant leadership because those above me don't. And my answer is, yes, you absolutely can. Yeah. Regardless of whether you are on the street and you don't have any formal rank or authority, you most certainly have leadership and you can display it there. But to get to your question, I'll actually give you an example and kind of an antidote of what happened is there was an individual, as I mentioned, is the higher you move up in rank, the less positions there are. So the competition becomes really palpable. And so there were a group of 10 of us, 10 lieutenants that were vying for a commander position, and only one can get the job. And we were all up for it. And I had my group of tormentors that were trying to do whatever they could to sabotage me. And by literally writing me up for every little thing. And, you know, if you watch someone, you know, and if you're not walking that tightrope, you know, but there's going to be a time where you make a mistake. And so it was just constant. And that was when I think I had the highest stress in my life, where they were watching and just seeing, where is she going to mess up? And I remember my chief calling me into the office, and he grabbed my hand and shook it. And he said, congratulations, Commander. And I had this moment of, are you kidding me right now? And he gave me the position. And he was a very progressive minded chief. And prior to him, people had promoted in their own likeness. They promoted their friends. And so for him, he was interested in diversity of thought. And so when he told me that, that meant that there were my competition who were upset, right? But now it's my job that now I have to supervise them. So now as a commander, I have these lieutenants that didn't want me to get the job, especially those who were outwardly sabotaging me. And I remember having a couple conversations with them. And my first instinct, and I don't know if this is a female thing, but I was apologetic, was like, oh gosh, I'm so sorry I got this, even though I knew that I deserved it. I mean, my resume, so proud of my resume. And I knew intellectually, conceptually, that I had earned this position. So there was I never had that kind of imposter syndrome where I truly believe I'm confident in my ability. But my first instinct was, oh, I'm so sorry you didn't get it. And then I decided, no. I had this moment in time where I changed that little voice inside my head. Instead of why me and being apologetic, I went, wait a hot minute, why not me? And then I reminded myself of how I had earned it. And so that caused me to have some conversations with people that were difficult. And by that, I mean, I called them in and here's what I said. I said, especially to one of them who was a major saboteur in my life, I said, I know that you think you should be sitting in this chair that I'm sitting in right now. You think you deserve it more than I do. You were on a trajectory of tactics and SWAT team, and I wasn't. I was in community policing, investigations. I said, so you believe that I am less than, but my value comes in a different path. And I said, so here's the thing. I need you. I need you on my team because I don't know the things that you know. You are better than me and all of that other stuff. So how about we work together with both of our strengths? And you come on my bus and you sit in the front row and let's move forward together. But then I said, but here's the thing. If you don't get on the bus, I'm going to run you over and then I'm going to back up and then I'm going to run you over again. And I think that caught his attention. And let me tell you, after that, he became one of my most valued members on my team. So that's one aspect in dealing with those who maybe you're competing with and or who are your saboteurs. I recognize that all the strengths he had that I didn't, but he needed to recognize the strength that I had that he didn't. And then furthermore, I started to notice that ego plays a big part in our organization. So the way that I think I led differently, and I don't know if this is female trait, I'm like, why are we fighting? Why are we all in our silos? It's all come to the table because it's easy to, I guess, maybe not work together when you're over there and we're over here. But if we come together, then we say, here's a problem that we can actually solve because you have some skills. I have some skills. You have some skills. So let's collectively think about that. And so for me, I think the key here is this, and then I'll land this plane. I know that I am not the smartest person in my organization. And I think that that's where we get into mistakes is some people think their collar brass is equated to their IQ in that the higher you move up in an organization or position, regardless of what it is, if you become the CEO, that you're suddenly the smartest. I never thought that. I had the 4 stars on my collar and still was like, guys, I have no idea what I'm doing here. What do you guys think? And I think that was something, at least I don't think, because I was told later, especially after I retired, people said, you gave us permission. And you basically said, I don't know the answer. So what do you guys think? And they said, you gave permission for people to use their skill, competency, and ability, and you didn't pretend like you knew it all. And for that, we were able to solve some pretty complex problems in our police department. And I think that's just the key to it. And I think there's a lot of men that do that too. So maybe it's not just a trait. I think there's a lot of great men that do that.
Well, I think it's an approach. And I love hearing what you're saying, because it seems to me, here's what my sense is and my experience has been. We hire supposedly the best, and then we tell them to sit down and shut up, yep, right? And we don't ask them what they think. There are some young people out there that are much, much better at social media than we could ever be. Why aren't we asking them questions, engaging them and getting involved and using their strengths? So I think you're right. You know, one of the first things I think you say is, I don't know it all. Even when I walk into a classroom, I'm Dr. Morelli, so yep, I don't know it all. I'm constantly learning. I'm learning from you today. There are so many things that you had said. I think what people don't realize who are outside of the business is that 95% of the officers who are sworn on a particular day will retire as an officer. Very few people take the plunge, raise their hand and say, I want to be in charge of other people. When I talk to sergeants and lieutenants, I say, how smart are you guys or gals that you had it, the tiger by the tail as a senior officer, right? You are responsible for you. You know how to get through things. You know how to do your job, and you don't have the added baggage of having to deal with 8 or 10 other people who are now your responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. And there's such honor in, like, we set such value. It's this template that we overlay, but you have to move up in an organization. And that is complete malarkey because, like you said, the vast percentage of people retire at that rank. And I think there is such honor in doing a remarkable job. And that honestly was my favorite rank of all, right? And at the end of the day, you take your last report, go 1042.
Yeah, I know that.
No headache. Yeah, right. No headache. Yeah.
No, I know that. And actually, the other thing that you were saying, and one of the things that I say an awful lot in training, and that is, it's exactly that problem. Listen, I'm glad we're at this training. You're injecting new ideas with us, but I'm here to tell you that I'm going back to a person who will say, I don't care what you learn. Do it my way. Do it the old way. And what I'll say to them is, look, as a sergeant or even a lieutenant, you can't control the entire department, but you can control the sphere of control that is entrusted to you, whether it is detective unit, a patrol sector, whatever it might be, or a unit, or it could be the fleet. You're responsible for a number of people. Do that well. Motivate them. Take some time to develop them. Kristen, how important in your mind is it or was it that a leader should be developing others?
Oh, this comes down to the very essence of servant leadership, which I understood at the sergeant's rank before knowing what that term meant. And the way that it was described to me, and I wish I could remember who said it to me, but you know, it was your job, and this is right as I was getting promoted to sergeant. Your job is not to exert that authority because you now have stripes on your arms and chevrons on your collar. Your job is now in a supervisory position is to get work done through others, which means your primary function is to remove barriers for your people. And I decided in that moment, it had so many supervisors and sergeants that I had worked with, the kind of sergeants that said this, hey, all right, guys, go have a great day out there. And listen, don't call me for 8 hours. Nobody bother me. And I thought
they'd be talking you out of arrest, right? Because I don't want the hassle, right?
Totally. You know, and I remember like having questions and going, okay, whatever I do, I absolutely cannot call my sergeant. And that was one of the things I marked down is if I ever get into a position of leadership, I will try to make myself available for my people. And so I decided that I was going to be the sergeant that I wanted to have. And that was really how I took every position to heart was, okay, what kind of supervisor do I want? What were the best ones? And I took examples from the best of the best. And so, yes, to your point is I would sit down and this is what the best supervisors do. Tell me where you want to be. Begin with the end in mind. Whoever is in your charge, decide where do you want to go in the department? Do you want to be a patrol officer? Because again, there is honor in that. But let me help you master that position. Do you want to move over to the gang unit, to vice narcotics, evidence, juvenile? What is it that you want to do? What are your aspirations? Let me help you figure out how to get closer to your goal. Do you want to promote? Are you on that trajectory? So let's sit down, look at some training classes. And also, you have to earn that as well. You have to still function and perform at this level. So you have to prove to me that you meet these expectations in your current role. And then let's look at where you want to go. And great leaders help people get to where they want to be.
No question. And I can't tell you where the quote came from, but it's one of the pieces of the draft book that I'm putting together. And it says, when you lead, it's all on you, but it's not about you.
Retweet. Yep. Right. Absolutely.
Right. What did you say? Retweet? I love
retweet.
It.
Retweet. Yeah.
Okay. The Send that out. Send that out.
I was just going to say to you, I had this on my desk. It says these words, it may not be your fault, but you are responsible. Yes. It always falls to your shoulders.
Well, what I was saying is, I don't really consider myself a teacher in the true sense that I really see myself, especially with colleagues in public sector, police officers and people who are sergeants, lieutenants, captains, majors and such, and even chiefs. I try to facilitate and you lead through questions. You know, what do you think about this? What do you do about that? What are the things that you can do? What troubles me about policing sometimes is it is a very difficult job. There's no question about it. You know, many of us who have done it, yourself included, have been under stress, have had maybe in some cases, while I know that PTSD has been reserved for those in war, there's times when police officers have the equivalent of war and what they see. I mean, I just read today that there were two officers who showed up at a beheading, and what a horrible thing to see. And of course, police are called on to do things and to go to things that most people will never see. And once you see those things, you can never unsee it. And I know you experienced that. I know you understand that very, very well. But it troubles me, too, that some police officers put policing at 100% of their life. Nothing else. No outside interest. It's policing, policing, and policing. And I remember that Colin Powell said that you have to avoid having your ego so close to your position that when your position falls, that your ego goes with it. And I know that you've experienced that, putting a square badge on and being a security guard after you retire. What are your thoughts on that?
You have so much to unpack there, you know, and the first of which it's the dirty little secret in our profession that we kill ourselves at a higher rate by our own hand than those who actually harm. And the numbers, they speak for themselves. And so those numbers tell us that we have a real crisis of mental health in our profession. And a lot of which is what you described. It begins, and I'm going to try to oversimplify this just for the sake of time, but it's that film reel that you just described, what I call the 1,000 tiny cuts. You don't have to go to a beheading or a mass shooting, like in my jurisdiction, but it's the rolling up on a scene where there's an accident and the family is killed. You just insert all the trauma here. You know, I could go on and on about the horrific things that first responders see. And they're human beings. We see more, you know, maybe in a shift or a month than people do in a lifetime. And that film reel continues to grind on even when work has stopped. But notoriously, we have been absolutely terrible at dealing with this and building resilience. And I'll go back to the word ego again, because that is the derivative of what we're grappling. And I'll give you a great example. In my department, as I mentioned, it was very autocratic leadership. And I remember saying one day to a commander where an officer had called me and said, and this is when I was in a supervisory position, and said, I'm having a real hard time with a scene that I was just on the other day. And I mentioned it to the commander. doctor and to my chief and said, listen, I think we need to be better about checking in with these guys because they're, you know, I didn't front the officer. I just said, but I think there's a lot of people who are hurting. And the commander's response to me was, oh, so I guess we have to check in on everybody and ask, are you okay? What a bunch of mamby-pambies. And I remember thinking, what the hell does that even mean? I had to look up that term, by the way, and it's not very kind. But I lost track of how many times I've heard the term, suck it up and take it. You know, you shouldn't be here if you can't handle it. Then don't take this job. And that's the approach that we take. I had an officer put a gun to his head and he didn't, thank God, pull the trigger because he made a phone call. And after making that phone call, he went into inpatient therapy. And as a result, he got his firearm card taken away because he was in a, quote, mental institution, even though he did the right thing and got help. And he was off the job for a year and a half on admin while I was fighting with my date for him to get his job back. So I say all of that to say, what message does that send when someone in rank calls you a mamby-pamby because you asked for help? And when someone who literally does ask for help before pulling the trigger goes in to get assistance into a mental health facility and now can't carry a gun, and which means they can't be a police officer, right? What message are we sending people? And so that's part of the problem. And that's why our suicide rate is so high. And dare I say, when we can't cope on the job, what happens to us? We turn to alcohol. How many divorces in our profession? And so then how do we treat people on the street? So all of this to say, it all manifests somehow in the way that we do our job. And what you said at the beginning was, we don't do a good job of the balance of wellness, meaning we hang out with other cops because we have the same days off, right? We've got Tuesdays and Wednesdays off. And, you know, so now our whole world becomes immersed in just law enforcement. And that's what happened to me. So you have to be deliberate in a few things. Number one, deliberate in getting help when you need it. And that means that the strongest people I know are the ones who are courageous enough to say, okay, man, this one is a little bigger than me and I'm really struggling with it and I need some help. And also take yourself out of your position for a minute and spend time with people who are not in law enforcement. Yeah. And that's a good place to start with this conversation.
I agree with that. I'm sure you've had the experience, but so many colleagues and very good friends have committed suicide and it's not an easy thing to go through. I understand that. And what I like is the discussion that's going on and catching on across the country is a required checkup from the neck up, where it is required that all of us once a year go and sit and purge and talk to somebody. It has to be the right person. It has to be somebody who understands police and police families and police jobs. But once you do that, it's quite cathartic to say, this is causing me some problems, you know, because all of us put these things in a box. We're all very good at that, I think. You put it in a box and you never know when it's going to leak out. And that's the problem. Tomorrow is 9/11. I'm going to have problems tomorrow. I brought a team to 9/11 in New York. And I've said this before, and I'm not looking for help. I'm not at this point, but no one ever asked how I feel about that, what I saw, what I experienced. No one to this day, no one. And that's just one little snippet of my career or your career and those kinds of things. So I think it's something that progressive police chiefs, innovative police chiefs are looking at and doing, so I can see some movement. I think that's good. Let's go back to the book for a moment. And by the way, I haven't said it in a little bit who I'm talking to. I'm talking to Kristen Zeman. She's sitting in Naples, Florida, beautiful Naples, Florida. She wrote a book, Reimagining Blue, Thoughts on Life, Leadership, and a New Way Forward in Policing. And again, I can't speak more highly about this book. There are a few things that I wrote down. You can pick one. You wrote a piece on power. You wrote a piece on no regrets. You wrote a piece on tormentors and snipers, and you've sort of alluded to that, and not the sniper side. Where do we go from here is the way I want to finish, but also power of symbols and that leaders disappoint. I'd like to focus on that for a moment. Talk about that experience you wrote about.
Starting with leaders disappoint, as you mentioned. So that was a concept given to me at Harvard. And I like to pause there for just a minute as though I actually went to Harvard, but I really just went there for a 3-week program. And Professor Marty Linsky stood in front of a group of us and he said, leadership is about disappointing people at the rate they can absorb. And I sat in my seat. I was a commander at that time. I sat in my seat and I thought, this man has lost his ever-loving mind. No, it's not. Leadership is about having a vision. It's about taking people where they don't know they need to go, where the organization needs to go. It's about inspiring people and all this beautiful butterflies and rainbows. And when he said it's about disappointing people, I thought, God, that's a horrific definition of leadership. And then I got promoted to chief and I was sitting in my chair, and it goes back to the concept of you're responsible. You know, when you are in any organization, you you tend to look towards the person in charge and go, bad leadership, say it. But hey, guys, this wasn't my idea. This wasn't my policy decision, but the person up there. And so you point always, it's over there. It's whoever is doing that. And I'm sitting in the big chair as the chief. And I just made a decision in my department because the buck stops with me. And I understood in that moment that 50% of the people were going to appreciate that decision. And 50% were going to absolutely loathe the decision. And as I'm sitting in that chair, I thought, well, Marty Linsky, I totally understand what you're saying. And it also goes to making changes. I wanted to change the culture of our organization, but I also understood that you have to be deliberate and you have to do it in a way that's not too fast because you know what they say about change. There's nothing worse than cops hate and change are things staying the same. So you have to find that sweet spot, right? And so I understood in that moment that as a leader, you are going to make decisions in your organization that are going to piss people off. And leadership is about disappointing people at the rate they can absorb, which simply means that you have to ask yourself these questions. And this was my litmus test. Am I doing the right thing for the right reasons and at the right time? And if I answered yes to all three of those questions, I had to be comfortable with disappointing people. And let me tell you, there were some times, and this is where you check your ego. There were some times where I finally got in the big chair. And remember, my tormentors and my snipers, I was like, oh, they tripped up. I've got them now. And now I'm the one who gets to administer discipline in the department. And I was like, okay, buddy, here we go. And then I did the, am I doing the right thing for the right reason at the right time? Oh, the answer is no. And so you cannot proceed. And so, you know, a little bit about that. I mean, is that leadership is you cannot take a leadership position without the understanding that you're going to make decisions that are going to upset people, whether it's personnel decisions, whether it's policy decisions and things of that nature. So it's about leadership.
What you're also saying, while there are plenty of people who take the position to get back at people who have given them a hard time and become vindictive, it's really not the right way to do that. I think that speaks to character. Is it the right thing to do? Can I get them back? Can I use that? There you go to power again. Can I use my power to get back at that person? Is it really worth it? Because I think it distracts you from the work that you are supposed to be doing for the greater good, not to swipe back at somebody who gave you a hard time a long time ago. It's interesting you say what you said about Marty Linsky, because I remember being in an academy, and I've been to so many academies, but I was at the New Hampshire Police Academy, and I remember this guy coming in, and he had, you remember the academy days, we were talking about tickets and writing tickets, motor vehicle tickets, and he said something that completely stirred the entire group, and it says, you don't write a ticket for attitude. Now think about that. And everybody's saying, bullshit, you don't write it about attitude. That guy gives me attitude. And we were fighting. He was just letting us go and letting us go and letting us go. And like Linsky, he was throwing a statement to get us to think differently. And it took the class probably 3 hours to figure out what he was saying. You didn't stop the person for an attitude. You stopped them for a violation. You're writing about the violation. The attitude may sway you how to use discretion one way or the other, but it isn't about attitude. And it really was one of those enlightening moments when you say, now I get it. It's similar, but dissimilar.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a whole chapter on power, and it literally talks about just that, is that we often look at power, and we also attach maybe a negative connotation to it, power. But power is actually can be very positive if you use that power for the best outcome, right? And in the book, I really try to delve into imbalance of power that police officers have to understand. And that imbalance of power is exactly that. And that is one, I actually go through Vandra Bland's incident, as Malcolm Gladwell did in his book, Talking Strangers. And in that high profile police incident, where you look at this interaction between the officer. And listen, I'm going to confess here that I have many times over the course of my career decided to write someone a ticket because they were mouthing off to me. And remember, like, I've got my pen out. Keep talking, because you're going to get another ticket. And that is precisely what I delve into, because that is the incorrect way to approach the problem, because that is not the best outcome. And that is where we as police officers have to look at our power and authority, and are we using it for the best possible outcome? And sometimes that means checking our ego to understand that even a person with a bad attitude who is escalating things, is that we often put the onus on that person, to whoever we're dealing with, to de-escalate, when really that's our job. And the essence of power is this very complex thing, because we see power corrupting. We see people abusing power. And I challenge officers to really look at, if there were an imbalance and abuse of, there is an imbalance of power, power. I mean, we can all agree on that. We walk in as a command authority. But if there is anywhere to abuse power, might it be in the gray area of discretion? And so I just ask officers to take a look at that, because we should be not exercising our authority as power over, but power with. Best possible outcome for it. And sometimes it is arrest. Of course, there's nothing soft about what I'm saying here, is that accountability matters, and we are going to need to take away people's freedoms, aka take them to jail. But there are other times where we can work through an issue with the best possible outcome instead of just exerting autocratic power and authority. But it takes a little more time to do it, but it's worth it.
Well, I think that's part of the training. And if you've got a rigid training officer, or you're at a department that is interested in counting beans, how many arrests have you made? How many citations did you write? Why are you writing more warnings than citations? It begins to jade the way you look, because I could tell you that I regret tickets that I had written in the past, because afterwards it turns out that that person is a business person. I run into him, I feel like a jackass that I wrote him up because he's friendly to me, and I befriend the guy. And so I think that's important. What we count is really important.
Yeah, it is. It sets the tone in an organization of what's important to the organization. In my department, people got shamed for not producing. There was a commander, he called it the point system, and you had to do X amount of things, make arrests, and you got put on a wall, and there was a ranking. And all that does is make people just write crappy citations and make crappy arrests that don't have great outcomes.
Yeah, volume,
you're not really driving down crime.
Right.
Yeah, you're not driving down crime.
Yeah, I agree. So, got to get to the end, because we've exhausted a discussion. I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. Kristen Zeman is who we're speaking with in Naples, Florida. And she is retired now, has written a book, Reimagining Blue, and is the former chief in Aurora, Illinois. I want to know how you would end. Where do we go from here? What do police chiefs, police leaders need to pay attention to right the ship?
Gosh, such a complex question, you know, and if I absolutely had the solution, I would be in my own island that I own somewhere. But here's where I believe we start. And this is how we end the book, is where do we go from here? We are most certainly at a crossroad in our beloved profession. And I think that you can love this profession and still understand that it needs to be better. And I think that's the first place we start. And I realize that's a little abstract, and get to the more concrete examples. But abstractly, what we need is to lose the blind loyalty. And that is where, especially in these high incidents that make headlines, these incidents that tarnish the badge across the nation, that we have to look at these incidents, not just nationally, but in our own departments, our own organizations, and say, okay, guys, here is the incident. Here's what happened. Here's how it unfolded. Let's talk about how we could have been better. Let's after action it. And listen, I'm not a big sports person, but those of you who love your sporty ball, this will make sense to you. You guys look at sports reels. That's what the professionals do. They pull the reels. Okay, guys, look at what happened here. What you do with your hand, where, you know, look at how you moved here. You dissect the reel, and then you make a determination and a tweak going forward,
make
how you're going to perform on the field.
Adjustments,
make
right.
adjustments. So why don't we throw up these videos and go, all right, guys, here is a traffic stop, and let's dissect it. Let's see, where could we have done better? And some people think that it's the judgment, or that you're calling an officer out. And to me, I look at it just the opposite. Is okay, let's learn from the incident so we can be better going forward. And we haven't really created a culture of doing that. Instead, we automatically jump to the side of the office. And instead of going, okay, hold on, you know, let's see where we could have maybe done a better job here to have taken this incident to a more peaceful outcome. So I think that's where we begin. And the second part is it's so funny about defunding the police. And I don't mean funny, haha, but when I first heard the term of defunding the police, I was like, oh my gosh, how are you going to defund the police? You want to abolish the police? And then I said, what does that mean? And people told me, well, we want to put more resources to social workers and to mental health professionals. And I said, oh my gosh, you guys, the police have been asking for that for years. We have all the social ailments that fall upon our shoulders, substance abuse, homelessness, mental illness. You called 911 for all of this. And now you're saying you want to take that away from us and put that to another agency. I was like, you guys have not been listening to us. Now don't take funding from my department, because my department, 93% is my personnel. But if you want to allocate fund or create legislation that puts funding. I would love that. Let's have social workers on. And if they can respond and we don't have to, boom, let's do it.
And actually, the great handoffs, we don't have handoffs on the weekends, as you understand. Mm-hmm. You wish, but social service is not available after 5 o'clock on a Friday. So what do you do when you have to babysit a child because you brought mommy and daddy to jail? Those kinds of things. Now, Kristen, I have to wind down, but one thing that you said that I spent a lot of time talking to sergeants especially is it's about budget. You just said something that I think will blow the minds of many people. You said 93% of your budget is about personnel. And I understand it's personnel, it's benefits, overtime, those kinds of things, which leaves you, what you're saying, 7% for everything else. Talk about how difficult it is to run a department with 7% discretionary money.
Oh, for sure. And then you look at cutting resources. So if you only have that 7%, what do you spend it on? I know the answer, and I'll tell you the answer. It's three things: training, 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 because you play like you practice. And so many departments, when they find themselves in budgetary constraints, the first thing that they cut is training. And yet that is the thing that truly needs to be amped up, because that's where lawsuits, that's where we make our stakes. And so I believe wholeheartedly that training needs to be first and foremost, and de-escalation training, active shooter training. We've seen in recent events here in our nation where officers did not rise to the level where their training should be. And now that is a tarnish across our entire profession. So that training has to be paramount. I remember looking at my CFO of my city who told me, your training budget is insane and we have to cut it. And I said, you will have to pry my training budget out of my cold, dead hand. But to your point is that you have to learn how to run a police department on these constraints, and you have to be creative in doing so. But I think to kind of wrap for your question is where we go from here is let's be open-minded. And I mean, we as law enforcement about some of these progressive reforms with social workers. We had social workers on our department before the murder of George Floyd, where it was demanded of us. We've been doing that. Let's come up with a new solution, maybe a hybrid model, because we can work together and then call in the police when that individual becomes violent. Let's look at some other solutions where we turn over homelessness to social service agencies and not have 911. So that's a good place to start, is let's revisit some of the systems and processes that we have always done traditionally. And let's look at what's a third alternative. But we have to get everybody to the table, because the best idea wins. And then I'll kind of leave it here. We already talked about mental health and wellness. And so that's another thing, because I firmly believe that hurt people hurt people. So we have to make sure our cops get the assistance they need so they can perform well on the street and treat people with human dignity and respect. And most importantly, we need to lean in. We are at a crossroads in our profession and in our country when it comes to divisiveness. Is it that you've got to pick a side and you're pro-police or you're anti-police? And here's the thing, you can be both. Like I said, you can be supportive of your police department and still want them to be better. And I think this is where we have to lean in into our community, especially the communities that don't trust the police. We have to make a point to build those relationships. And it sounds so cliche and it sounds so trite, but you asked me earlier how I run a meeting. No different than how I run a community meeting. It's no different, is that you bring police officers to the table and you bring people to the table who live in communities, and you say, what's the problem here and how can we fix it together? And so it's the same solution that we have in our board meetings and in our command staff meeting and in our sergeant's meeting. It's the same formula, is that we have to lean in and we have to ask, tell me what your idea is. And that is where I think that we can transform an entire profession, an entire community, and an entire nation, so that we have the support of our residents.
Well, I'm going to leave that as your last word, because I think you have been very, very helpful and open and forthright. I can see why you were successful, Kristen. I can. And I wish you the best of luck. We're talking to Kristen Zeman. She is the author of Reimagining Blue and former chief, Aurora, Illinois. Thank you for being here. Your day is going to begin down in Naples on I hope it's a sunny Saturday. Is it? It is.
It is. Another sunny day. It's pretty much always sunny.
Yeah. Just rub it in. So that's it. That's another episode of the Cop Doc in the can. I'm Steve Morielli, coming from Boston, and we're just finishing with Kristen Zeman in Naples, Florida. Thank you very much, Kristen, being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Doc. I appreciate you having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.